Today on the Orville Universe podcast, we are talking about a different piece of Star Trek adjacent media, Galaxy Quest. Is this show a loving send-up of Star Trek? Is it a wonderful homage to the fans? And why is it that cute animals always wind up killing you?
All that right after this. It's like some Holy Grail stuff right there.
Exactly.
Welcome to the Orville Universe Podcast. My name is Matthew Carroll.
I'm Matthew S. Fox.
What's up, buddy?
Not too much, not too much. Glad to be talking with you again. It's been a minute.
Yeah, man, it has. It has. I was just excited to get to do one with you because we've both been busy with lots of things. But, since we last spoke, we are officially part of the Stranded Panda Network. That's a thing now.
We are. It's been a thing. We are. And I have now officially launched a new podcast talking about the Star Wars universe. So we have and you now have a new one talking about binging, I believe.
Yeah. Binge eating, binge drinking. No. we have a new show. It actually launched this week as well. Bingers Assemble.
Nice.
So, man, the Stranded Pandaverse is growing. So you guys can all go to strandedpanda.com if you want to know more about what me and Matthew are doing. And we'll be back in the Orville feed soon with more episodes, but since it's been a while, we wanted to drop something fun, and I just freaking love this movie, so we're going to talk about Galaxy Quest today.
Yeah, that's how I feel. Like, I know you and I, when we first started talking about Orville, one of the things we went into a lot was how this was really scratching that itch that we hadn't had for a while of wanting a good Star Trek-style show. And to me, you know, we've been thinking about how it's a long time till the next Orville comes out. It's supposed to be coming out, I believe, the winter of 2020. And so we're going to probably do a rewatch of season 2 of Orville, starting probably the summer of this year to kind of get everybody ready for that. But we wanted to have something to do to kind of keep the spirit alive. And when I think about things that are kind of Star Trek adjacent and really kind of, well, let me ask you this. What do you remember the first time you saw Galaxy Quest and kind of what you're thinking going into it and what you thought coming out of it?
I don't remember. I have no idea. This movie exists in a place in my brain where it's like it has just always existed. And I remember going to the theater to see this movie, but I don't think I knew what it was about at all. And remember coming out loving it. The way this connects to Orville to me in the most interesting sense is that, like, it's a Star Trek parody.
Yeah.
But it's not just a Star Trek parody. And that's exactly what the Orville is. It's a Star Trek parody, but then it like loops around back on itself and becomes a serious thing again. And this does the same thing. This is a Star Trek parody that loops around back on itself, and suddenly you're invested in an actual sci-fi adventure.
I think that's a great way of putting it. And I asked that question because I really do remember the first time I saw it. What I remember is at the time that it came out, you know, Star Trek was still something that was not like, you know, everybody was in love with it, and it was a huge popular thing.
Oh yeah, like today. Today it's the biggest thing in media.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and like, you know, it's age of the geek, baby. Like being a comic book guy, being a Star Trek gal, you know, all that is totally okay. When Galaxy Quest came out, I didn't tell many people that I was a big Star Trek fan because I got made fun of a lot for it. And I remember when I saw the preview, I thought, oh, okay. So it's a movie that's going to poke fun at me and my friends.
Right. Especially starring Tim Allen. I just felt like, oh, it's the Home Improvement guy making fun of Captain Kirk.
Exactly. Exactly. And I saw that there was going to be like a scene or two at, at a Star Trek convention type thing. And I was like, oh, this is just going to be making fun of us. And friends of mine convinced me to see it. And I was so blown away because it's the difference between, like, you know, the Stranded Panda idea, you know, all of it, like, we as geeks are very self-deferential. Like, we love to make fun of ourselves. But that's very different than when it feels like we're being bullied or someone is making fun of us from outside of the group. And Galaxy Quest feels like that kind of self-deferential love, you know? It feels like self-detriment. Like, it's not, you know, the popular kids making fun of the geeks. It's the geeks saying, like, yeah, we're ridiculous. We know that. The shows we love are ridiculous. We know that. Our going to cons and being so obsessed with it is kind of ridiculous, and we know that. But you know what? Our being super obsessed with all this stuff and knowing the exact details of the ships from the show we saw 20 years ago, it just might save the world one day. And I loved that. It felt like it wasn't like a mean parody. It was a loving send-up of, to me, not just Star Trek, but of Star Trek fandom in a way that just made me so happy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, just the overall conceit is a blast. The fact that it's a bunch of actors who think they're an alien race thinks they're heroes and calls them up like they're calling up the Avengers to come solve a problem. Like, that in itself is a funny, funny conceit. And even if that had nothing to do, like, if this was made about the Fast and the Furious crew.
Yeah.
And, like, someone called Vin Diesel, The Rock, and whoever else to come solve a problem in the underworld of car racing.
Yeah. Like,
that would be a great idea for a movie. I would watch that. It'd be wonderful. But it's like layered on top of Star Trek, which is my favorite thing. Like, and it's just so fun, man. It's so fun.
And I think part of what it gets at is that in a lot of the world of media, but especially in Star Trek, somewhat in other things, but I think Star Trek more than almost anything else, the line between the media and the reality can get pretty blurry at times for people. Sometimes in funny ways, sometimes in like kind of eyebrow raising ways. But like, the idea that, you know, you look at like some of the actors who were in some of these shows, and this is now, you know, going to conventions and continuing to keep those parts alive has become their life. And even like someone like Jean-Luc Patrick Stewart, who managed, you know, had an incredible career long before Star Trek, went off and did lots of great things after Star Trek. I actually got to see him in Shakespeare in the Park, which was amazing. But now he's still come back to it. I feel like one of the things this movie really gets is that the way in which that for fans, these things can really take on a life of their own, and that can be, you know, a little bit silly and a little bit ridiculous, but kind of wonderful. And the movie just feels like it gets that in a way, you know, which I really appreciate. I remember going to this movie and feeling like this movie gets me as a fan.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love, you know, you talk about that exact thing, and they address that in the movie with the main character played by Justin Long, not the main character, the main nerd played by Justin Long, who walks up and he asks the captain about his plans. And I never understood this. What does this do? And he's like, it's all fake, kid. It's not a real ship. And he breaks his heart.
Yeah.
Cause he treats him bad. And then he calls him. He's like, I want you to know I'm not a crazy person, but then as soon as he finds out it is all real, he's fully on board, because let's face it, we all would be if we found out that we found out the Enterprise existed and we could go there. I don't know. I'd be there, man. I'd be there.
No, I mean, and that's the thing. It's part of why I think we all make these podcasts, and I hope for our listeners, it's why you listen in, is because it's fun to really dive into, why was the Enterprise C built this way and the Enterprise D built that way? And I know on your own Star Trek Universe podcast with you and Dave, you know, one thing you guys have gotten into is the degree to which as more and more Star Trek shows have gone on, you know, they have not always been, have had perfect fidelity to the images of the Enterprise or the images of different parts of the canon. I know for myself, one of the things it makes Discovery unwatchable for me is the Klingons. Like, they just don't feel like Klingons are supposed to. And to a lot of people, that might seem utterly ridiculous. But to me, like, that's what, in this movie, it's like you said, the fans, they know those details so much, and it winds up that those details are what they need to save the day. And let's just talk about that for a minute, because I think, to me, one of my favorite parts of this movie is that in some ways it's the fans who are the heroes. You know, we get to this situation where our crew, the actors, are in space, they're dealing with these terrible things, and it's only when they're able to communicate with the fans, the kids, that the kids who know so much are actually able to, like, you know, pull their butts out of the fire.
For sure, yeah. It shows in this movie that they're not trying to crap on the fans. Like, they really, I think it's a very clear, like, look, we're going to make the fans the heroes. This is not about making you feel silly for thinking so. Because in a way, in a different light, the crew of the ship is also representing fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a little, they're given honor throughout the movie, but they're also a joke throughout the movie. You know what I mean? Right. So like it kind of pulls from both sides. Like, it definitely does pick on the fans a little bit. The idea that a crew of aliens would be such big fans of a show. Basically, they base their entire life on it. Like, that's, I think that's pretty clearly like a different kind of send up of the fans. But
oh yeah, that's true. Oh, you mean of the Thermians?
Thermians. Yeah,
yeah.
I think the Thermians are a representation of the fans in a different way. Even they're given a lot of honor in the way they're treated throughout the movie, as just a people trying to survive and I think trying to thrive and using they just used Galaxy Quest as a way of inspiring their society. They used it as a thing to strive for. It's in many ways it's their religion, even if it's not true, you know?
Yeah. and I do think it's interesting because the way it's created is this idea that their society literally has no concept of fiction and no concept of lying, really, at least not in that way. And so the idea that there could that these TV shows could be anything but historical documents is utterly alien to them.
Yeah.
And so what do we have? We have one culture having to communicate with another culture, and in that other culture, they have a fundamental difference of communication styles that makes communicating between the two difficult.
Absolutely.
That sounds like a Star Trek episode, doesn't it?
It definitely does. The amount of meta stuff that's going on in this and how tightly written this movie is.
Yeah.
In the very first, the movie opens with an actual scene from Galaxy Quest.
Right.
And you watch a scene from Galaxy Quest. And if you've seen the movie, there are tons of little like jokes and references to things that are going to happen. And they're establishing the crew and who they are and what they do and their taglines and everything in the first like moments of this movie by showing you what Galaxy Quest is and establishing as a thing in the world. And then they go on to tell those same jokes and sort of put twists on them throughout the movie. And then, yes, they live a Star Trek episode in that they meet a culture that doesn't know what lying is, and so it doesn't understand acting.
Right.
Have you seen Invention of Lying?
I have. I think I saw previews for it. I did not actually see it.
I recommend it. You know what? It's been years since I've seen it all the way through, so I don't know how I feel about the last half, but I literally watched the first half the other day because I just fell asleep during it. But the first half of the movie, one of the conceits of the movie is because there is no lying, there is no acting. And the biggest blockbusters in the theater are people reading to camera dramatically the stories of the past.
Oh, interesting. That's and hysterical. So
one of the and the guy who's a who's the main character who invents lying, so at some point in the film, since he's the only one with the power of lying, he starts to embellish. His job is to make the 13th century interesting, and he can't. He's doing a really bad job of it. He's going to lose his job. So he starts embellishing what happened in the 13th century.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so that's one of the ways the movie kind of falls down the rabbit hole of like lying, how it kind of saves his butt, but then it gets him into lots of trouble. And
That's hilarious.
It's a great movie. You'd love it, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, it's definitely one I want to check out. I'm fascinated by things like that, about take a basis of our communication and what happens when you play with it.
Mm-hmm. It's funny to call lying a basis of our communication.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate. I am a Slytherin after all. Just going back to the beginning, I just kind of have some random notes. We don't have like a kind of a fixed outline or anything, but just one of the things that I loved is that how much, like you said, that first scene that establishes that this is what the TV show The Galaxy Quest looked like. It looks so much like Star Trek, down to the fact that they have their very own Wesley Crusher. Like, the fact that they have an annoying kid on the bridge who, like, is telling people what to do. I was just like, that is so clearly a Wesley Crusher reference in a way that makes me so happy. In a way, almost nothing about Wesley Crusher ever did. I just love that they throw that in.
Absolutely. And it was a trope of like certain TV shows of the era would put a kid on the thing just to like make the kids relate, I guess. Ever since Robin was added to Batman, you know, like that's why they did that. Was to make kids relate to the comic book. And now we have the ethical conundrum of, do we make Robin older or do we keep it the classic Robin a thing?
Yeah.
Ever since then, they keep making Robin more and more like, well, he he had lots of problems before that, or he was an assassin before Batman's, like, Batman's just honing the edges now, you know, making him a,
right,
making him less of a vigilante or whatever. I don't know. It's funny.
Certainly they have stopped having him dress in yellow and red and green, which yes. makes a little more sense for the creatures of the night. Although I do appreciate the web cartoons and things like that, that I see that say, you know, why does Batman have him dressed like that? It's because, you know, that way he's a better target than Batman.
Yep.
But
yeah, he's the distracting target.
But okay. Yeah. So going back to this, what else do you think you picked up on that you've made this feel like very much like a Star Trek send off or parody or just kind of Star Trek adjacent?
Well, I mean, I can't even, there's just so many things, obviously, yeah. I mean, it's everything in it. Tim Allen losing his shirt. It's Kirk always losing his shirt, God, on the planet. Yeah. It's Kirk going down to the planet and having to be the one to fight the monster. It's everything. Tim Allen as a Kirk, by the way, I know Tim Allen has some detractors these days, but man, I love that guy from like as an actor. I think he's hilarious.
I thought he was very good. The one moment where I was like, I don't believe this, is you get a moment early on where Tim Allen's like in the bathroom and he hears the fans like talking about him as a has-been and like, you know, what an idiot he is. And it's part of what gets him so depressed and part of what gets him to the point where he cancels things and kind of speaks badly to that fan. I can't believe William Shatner would ever give a damn what anyone thought about him like that.
Ooh, see, I don't agree. I think there's,
yeah.
I think Shatner's a sensitive dude, actually.
Interesting. Okay.
I think that, like, he puts on a gruff front, but I think that Shatner, I mean, he's a human. Like, I think we're all that way, that we all can be like hurt. But just like from his, have you heard his album, The Transform Man? Not the Transform Man.
No, I haven't.
I'm sorry, not the Transform Man. That's the ones from the 60s. He has an album called Has Been, and it's actually
Okay,
one of my favorite albums, and is great.
Is that the one of him like kind of half speaking, half singing a whole bunch of songs, but in his very traditional Shatner kind of presentation?
So the answer is yes.
Okay,
but all of his albums are that way. I think he may have three or four albums now. This was his second. He did one in like the 60s or 70s called The Transformed Man, and it's like him dramatically reading Shakespeare over and then dramatically reading pop songs. It's real strange.
Oh, but that's interesting.
This one is all original content. So he wrote all these songs.
Okay.
But then Ben Folds put them to music.
Oh, weird. Okay.
It's one of the weirdest pop culture things ever. And then it has one song that was written by Nick Hornby. So Nick Hornby wrote the lyrics, who I love Nick Hornby, About a Boy, High Fidelity, all those great books. Nick Hornby wrote the lyrics. Shatner sings it, but Ben Folds wrote the music. And it is a trip of an album, man. It is a trip. But in that album, he talks a lot about his emotions and just like really talking about being a human being. And some of it's real silly. Some of it's like literally like stop called thinking I'm Captain Kirk kind of songs. But other ones is just about him being human and hurt. And there's one song about like, it sounds like it's going to be silly. And then there's one song where he like recites a poem about finding his wife dead.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It gets dark and it's strangely emotional, and I highly recommend it.
I'll definitely check that out, and so maybe this is a more accurate Shatner than I would have thought.
I think it's possible for him to get hurt like that.
I have no idea if Leonard Nimoy actually like got this upset at the way that people treated him after Spock.
Well, he did write a book called I'm Not Spock.
Yeah.
because people wouldn't stop treating him as Spock.
Alan Rickman's portrayal rings so true to me for that, both because of, in a way, it's almost a little bit the Patrick Stewart idea of this very Shakespearean British actor who kind of gets stuck in this role and can never get out. But also just because, I mean, I think it's true. Like, I don't think this happened as much with Next Generation because there was a wider, you know, collection of characters to fall in love with. But especially, like, my mother was she wasn't as geeky, but she really loved she really loved the original Trek, and through her, I came to know a lot about the fandom of the original Trek. And it really was like, I mean, Spock and Kirk and a little bit McCoy were really the people to fix on. And people thought Kirk was attractive, But Spock was really the one who got the people obsessed, you know, because he was so different and he had such this interesting way of life, way of looking at life and being somewhat alien, but somewhat not. And I so thought the way that they portrayed Alan Rickman with that was so perfect in how that's the one who everyone would look to. And he's the one with a great tagline and he's the one everybody would try to emulate, even though it would drive this actor absolutely insane.
Yes. And I got to say, favorite line of the movie, and it is just one of the best pieces of acting ever. I freaking love it. It is so emotional when...
I think I don't talk about it, but yeah, go for it.
When he has... Throughout the entire movie, one of his first lines is, I'm never saying that line again. He just resists the whole, by Grapthar's hammer, I will avenge thee, is like the thing he never wants to say again. He hates it. And then he gets out on stage and like his previous self is saying it on the screen. He's like, he hates it so much. And they try to say, Quellic is a young Thermian who has followed the teachings of him, basically.
Yeah.
And then it is the most emotional scene ever when Quellic gets shot and he says, I'm shot. And then he falls forward and then he tells Alan Rickman's character that he always viewed him as a father figure, even though he never knew him.
Yeah.
And in that moment of death, he looks down and just recites, by Grapthar's hammer, by the sons of something, I forget. And he says, I will avenge thee. I'm tearing up thinking about how good that scene is, because what it is, it's that actor realizing how important this is to this kid.
Yeah.
And this kid is dying and he's kind of letting him have the fiction as in death and like giving of himself a thing he never wanted to give again. But he's giving of himself, and he actually kind of means those nonsensical words for the first time in his life, and it is Alan Rickman, like, at his most dramatic, reading the silliest line in the movie. It's just so good.
I'm definitely getting choked up thinking about it, and I totally teared up when that happened, because it's... You're right, it's this wonderful reminder of that the thing that you can do that might seem so silly and ridiculous to you and might get made fun of by everyone can still mean so much to anyone else. Like, do you know the story of how Whoopi Goldberg like became a really big Star Trek fan and why she winds up as Guinan?
I believe so, but you feel free to go for it.
So yeah, just for our listeners who haven't known it, the story goes that when a young Whoopi Goldberg was watching TV in the 60s at home as a young girl, you know, she saw Star Trek for the first time, and she saw Lieutenant Uhura. I think it's Lieutenant, whoever it is, but Uhura, as a black woman on screen with an important job, doing important things on the starship. And the story goes, she went running to her mom and said, "Mommy, mommy, there's a black woman on TV, and she ain't no maid." I heard her tell that story and talking about why that apparently she like, you know, kind of pushed hard to be on Next Generation because that moment had really meant a lot to her about like, wait a minute, I'm a black woman, but I can be on television and I don't just have to be a mammy. I don't just have to be, you know, a black stereotype. I can be a real character, and that it kind of helped, you know, push her as a little girl to want to go into acting. And that's part of why that scene from The View of Patrick Stewart now asking her to come back to the Picard show means so much to me. And that's what I think about when I see that moment is like, you know, I have no idea the woman who played Lieutenant Uhura, how seriously she saw it or, you know, whether she saw it as a great career move or just a paycheck or whatever it was. But I can't imagine what her reaction must have been when she, you know, first heard that story from Whoopi Goldberg of like, hey, this woman who went out to have like an amazing career in Hollywood, it happened in part because you played Uhura. I love that. And I feel like that you're right. That is probably the emotional heart of the movie. And it's so powerful in part because Alan Rickman has made so clear how much he doesn't want to do this, you know, and it's not that the guy asks him to say it. It's not that Tim Allen sort of nudges him and he kind of grudgingly says, okay, this will help. It's he's caught up in the moment. And in the moment, he knows that's the thing to say.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier, it's their religion. like Galaxy Quest is there, is the Thermians religion. And one of the things that drove that home for me was when I know with you having a Christian background, you being a Christian guy, I think you'll hear this too. When Mathazar, who's the leader of the Thermians, he's being tortured by the villain, and he goes over and Tim Allen's character tries to tell him, like, it's not true. None of this is true. The ship is this big. And he holds up his fingers and says, the ship you saw on screen was this big.
Right.
And he said, how can that be? Inside I have seen many rooms. And to me, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but it reminded me so much of in my home there are many mansions.
Oh, like interesting.
The Christian allegory for heaven. But inside I have seen many rooms. It was, to me, that was directly connecting that this is the Thermians' religion. Like, believe this.
It may be a sign that you're more of a Christian than I am, because my first thought was of Doctor Who, of it's bigger on the inside. but I think you make a good point, and I think it's entirely possible that that was an intentional reference. One of the things with Christian ideology is so much of it is so iconography, is that so much of it's so deep in our culture we don't even realize we're referencing
it. For sure. It just, to me, rung that way and made me think even more when Quellic is dying, that's his religion, and Rickman is giving of himself so that he can believe in his moment of dying that he did the right thing, that he lived the right way, and that his father figure is going to stand over him. It's such a powerful moment. It's so crazy.
And to me, that's powerful because, and I think I've said this before, certainly on some of our podcasts, and I think on the Orville Universe podcast, is, when I was in grad school and I studied sociology of religion, we took the idea of, like, what are the sociological markers of a religion in terms of how it functions in society, and looked at some other things that are basically the equivalent of religions, and Star Trek fandom was very much one of them. Especially when you think of, like, you know, people who raise their kids. My mother did this. My mother, you know, would have me watch a Star Trek episode with her, and then we would talk about the moral lessons that it raises. That's Bible study. Like, that's you know, what these things are. Kind of looking over my notes and talking about some of the other things, just a couple of small... there are a couple of things that I noted that were kind of small scientific nonsense details, and I don't want to give the writers too much credit, but there's a part of me that wonders if this was just them not paying much attention, or if this was them intentionally screwing things up in the same kind of way that early Star Trek did a lot. One of the things that I noticed is at one point they're talking about map details, and they make reference to quadrants 32 and 34, which, if a quadrant is dividing something into four parts, that statement makes no sense whatsoever. And then just a lot of things like that I picked up on.
Yeah, that's funny.
One other thing that I loved, just again, because it's in that kind of, like, both sending it up, but because here's the thing, I think most Star Trek fans would be the first ones to say, like, what we love, there's also a lot of parts about it that are really bad, and it's fun to make fun of those and to laugh about those. There's an episode of, there's the moment where they get to the chompers, and they realize that to get across the ship, there's these, like, smashy chomping things that make no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
And Sigourney Weaver's character just kind of mentions, as they're going through this, like, this episode was really badly written.
Yep.
And I just love that, because it's true. There's a number of times where, and I feel like as Star Trek's gotten further and further away from the original series, there's less of this, but in the original, and certainly some of the new generation stuff, there's some tech stuff that just makes no sense except to be a plot point.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And you know, things like that, where you're just, like, battling the internal parts of the ship. It make no sense for it to be there, and, like, I don't know that ever actually happened on screen, but it wouldn't surprise me too much.
Yeah.
But it just, it's a really silly thing. And yeah, there's a lot of silly stuff in Star Trek here and there.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite thing about this movie, other than just everything, like the conceit and the execution, it's all wonderful, but the cast, man, everyone in it is great. Sam Rockwell, like a young Sam Rockwell being in there is amazing. As I said, I love Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver. I think Alan Rickman, of course. Tony Shalhoub steals every scene for me.
Yeah. He is so good.
His character's written really well, and his delivery of all those really funny lines when they all go through the teleportation for the first time, and they're all completely freaked out and frozen and can't move. He comes through and just goes, "Whew, that was a hell of a thing," and he just gets off the transporter and he's fine. I freaking love it. I also love how they all fall into their roles immediately. Like they did this for so many years on the show, I guess they just like know what to do, and they start doing their roles without even thinking about it.
I just want to say one thing on Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah,
that he's the one who gets to have a sex scene with the cute alien lady.
Right.
And there's that moment where like you see his like the alien tentacle kind of coming out, and he kind of notices it and goes with it. And yep. I just put in my notes, is this the moment when hentai came to America? And like I say that as in a joke because like. I think this is just kind of a weird coincidence because in 1999, as far as I know, the hentai thing wasn't anywhere near as big as it is today, with it being like such a common joke among geeks today, or not even joke, like a big thing that a lot of people like. And I'm not trying to yuck that yum if that's the thing people are into.
I'm not sure.
I don't think it really was back then. And so I find it kind of funny that like there's this little offhand mention of it. And today, like if you threw that in, people would go absolutely crazy.
Right. I've never been into sort of anime and stuff at all. But I knew the word hentai in the 90s.
So okay.
I think it was around, but I don't know if it's... It clearly wasn't as big as it is now with the internet and access to everything. But I remember someone telling me what that term meant or whatever, that it was like sexualized anime, basically. At least that's the way I know the term. I don't know if that's an accurate description.
My understanding, and I'm like you, fairly ignorant here, but my understanding is it's not just sexualized anime, but it's specifically involved tentacles play a very big part of it. I'm not really sure beyond.
Interesting.
That.
I don't know. I'd have to look it up. I am a novice on this, but I think hentai is just anything sexual because I don't think it all involves tentacle. There is like a large bit of tentacle stuff in that. But I don't know, man. I'm sure there's an internet. I'm gonna look it up because
now that we have rendered our entire episode 100% not safe for children.
That's fair. this is bad. This is bad. I just searched the word hentai on my computer.
Oh no! Mistakes were made. Abort. Anyway, folks, can you see that we have a very like well thought out outline for this? Generally, it's my job to do those. And Matt asked me as we were getting ready for this episode, like, what did you do to prepare? And I said, well, I wrote down a bunch of my favorite quotes. So if we're a little all over the place, well, that's kind of in fitting with the theme of this movie. That being said, before we go too far down the hentai rabbit hole, is there anything else, any other kind of big points you wanted to talk about or get into?
Just because I'm on it. It's apparently just a general term for pornography, basically.
Okay.
Manga related pornography.
Okay. So
I think we kept that pretty PG, right?
Yeah,
I don't think we went too crazy. Anyway.
I'm sure that any parents will be happy that our conversation about internet tentacle porn did not involve curse words.
I think so. I think there's value in that.
Just a couple other little details that I loved. I loved that the fans were shipping different, like that the fans so clearly wanted characters and to some extent the actors to get together. Because again, that's it. What I think is fascinating is in some ways, not only is this a send up and a love letter to fan culture, but it almost predicts fan culture because, you know, fan fiction was definitely a thing back then, but it was nowhere near as big as it is today. None of this was. And in some ways, I feel like Galaxy Quest not only is saying, look how great fan culture is, but all the things fan culture has become are in this movie, too.
For sure. Well, I think that's showing that this existed. It may not have been as big as it is now, but this was all this stuff was already there. And this is 20 years ago. And this stuff was already in the fan culture, but it was a much smaller scene then. And now that fan culture has just become pop culture. And it's just everything now.
One other thing that also hit me about this, we kind of touched on this, but I wanted to reiterate it from a different direction, is that scene, like you said, where Mathazar has to realize that all this is fake and all this is a lie. It is a very weird kind of heartbreaking scene between him and the cast, because, and I think it's one that a lot of people can relate to, which is one where, you know, I think a lot of us, myself especially included, and especially a lot of us in geek culture, you know, all of us stranded pandas, we often can really be very self-deprecating and think that the things we're doing are meaningless. You know, I think it's very easy for me to think, like, these podcasts I'm putting out into the world, like, you know, no one really pays that much attention. It hasn't really affected anyone that much. And it's such an interesting mind twist to me to think about, like, I'm kind of stroking my own ego here, but just to kind of put myself in the Tim Allen shoes there, the idea that I would ever meet someone who took superhero ethics so seriously that I could then let them down by not living up to what I had created. It's a very humbling kind of thought, in a way, you know, to think that, like, we as creators, and this is not just for podcast people, it's for anybody, we all put things out into the universe, but that there are, no matter how down on yourself you are, to someone else, you might be a hero. To someone else, you might do things that really move them and touch them, so much so that when you tear those things down, you might hurt someone. And that, like, we can talk about all the kind of response, that gets in all kind of crazy ethical questions about what responsibility that has, and not that someone else should put that on you. But I think there's just I could really identify with Tim Allen in that moment, and how humbling that must be to have that moment of, like, I never really thought that something I did could have this kind of power on someone else, and that it could have this effect.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that. My initial thought with that is actually that that's Tim Allen's arc in this movie, Jason Nesmith or whatever, his arc in this movie, and that's why that moment is so extra powerful. Is he is a sort of narcissistic, bloated actor type,
right? Who
all of his closest friends hate him, and when he finds out all of this is real, he's excited, but he's not excited about space, and he's not excited about the fact that there are aliens. He's excited about actually getting to live the role of the character that everyone thinks he is.
Yeah.
And so when he has to admit to Mathazar that he isn't that person, it's like extra heartbreaking, because his whole arc has been him wanting to be that person on the planet. When he sends everyone into the ship and then he stays behind, like, he is sacrificing there, but he is sacrificing, and Alan Rickman sees through it. I love this line, because it's his sacrifice play. He pushes the beryllium sphere onto the little shuttlecraft. They take off and he stays behind and fights the aliens and the rock monster.
Right.
And Rickman says, it's always about you. And it's like, he's sacrificing himself, but Rickman knows him well enough to know that that's not a sacrifice for him. He wants to be the guy who makes the sacrifice play, but not because it's a sacrifice. He just wants to be seen that way.
Yeah.
And so when he has to bear in front of Mathazar, the guy with the greatest faith in him, the fact that he is nothing. He's an empty suit. He has nothing to give Mathazar. It is terrible. It tears me apart to see his character go through that.
Mm-hmm.
And especially to see Mathazar go through that. It's really hard. Especially with the Saris is his name. I always forget the name of the villain, but Saris, the villain is doing such a good job of twisting the knife and being just so sadistic.
Mm-hmm.
So good. It's all so good.
Yeah. I just love this movie.
Me too.
I think we're about hitting an ending point. Is there anything more you wanted to say?
I had a few other things in my notes. Let's see. A couple of lines I just love. I really love when the Thermion, who's standing there at the transporter, for lack of a better term, and they transport the pig back, this pig monster, and
it turns
and it's like just a grotesque, awful body horror thing. And they say, he said, how did it make it? Tim Allen's character is like, did it make it up there? Because they were trying to beam him up next. And they all go, oh, yeah, it did fine. And then the Thurman, who doesn't know how to lie, says, it turned inside out.
That was really wonderful.
And then it explodes, and there's goo all over the walls, and all the actors duck under the thing. And the Thurman stands there, gets hit in the face with all this goo, and then he just says, and exploded. It's just so good. And I really love Tony Shalhoub, like everything he says about his engineering crew.
Uh-huh.
I love when he calls up to the bridge and says, hey guys, just calling to say that we're going at top speed too long and we need to slow down. The guys say, we'll burn out the engines if we don't do a little better. Uh-huh. I don't think she can handle this. And it's a classic. He's quoting Scotty is what he's doing, but he's like, it's almost like the whole movie, Tony Shalhoub never realizes where he is or what he's doing. Like yeah. He never gets the memo that they're actually in space. He's like still playing the role and he's playing it really disaffected. And I just freaking love it. But then he also buys in fully to being the engineer. Later in the movie, they have this big fight with the guys, the bug monsters or whatever they are. They shove them out of airlock. And then he turns to the captain and says, oh, I saw that that door stuck a little bit there. I'll get one of my guys down here with some WD-40 to fix that.
I will say the one thing that I loved was the fact that they basically like have so much fun with the concept of a red shirt. You know, because we have a red shirt who like, and the whole time he's so nervous because he's like, you know, he's basically just like someone who's just kind of along for the ride. He's kind of a fan because he's. He's kind of half a fan and he's half like trying to make a career out of this. And then they just keep jumping. Like he knows the whole red shirt conceit, you know, he knows exactly what's happening. I freaking loved it.
I love them talking about his role throughout the movie. Maybe you're the plucky comedy relief.
Yeah.
I love that. And then at the end, he's actually on the show as a security officer and he has his like short sleeve shirt on and he's like, pointing to the camera. It's so good, man. Mm-hmm. It's so good.
Yeah, no, it's so good. All right, so I think let's kind of start wrapping it up. To our listeners, what did you guys think? Obviously this movie's pretty old and I'm hoping for some people maybe you haven't seen it before and this is going to be your kind of inspiration to see it. What did you love? What did you not love? What about this kind of is a send up to you of Star Trek, or how do you see it? We'd love to hear from it. We have a Facebook, we have an email, I think we have a Twitter account, all that, it's been a little while since we recorded one of these, but all that information will be in our notes, in the show notes you can find online. Matt, if they want to hear more from you, where can they find you?
Well, you know, I'm doing a lot of stuff these days, but pretty much everything is at strandedpanda.com. Oh, and if you're listening to The Orville, you're probably a Star Trek fan. I don't think I was doing this last time we recorded. I've been writing a song a week for Star Trek. And that's kind of been my biggest push lately. I wrote an entire album called Earl Grey Hot. You can find it on any of the services under the band name The Garage. The album's called Earl Grey Hot, and it's about 10 episodes of Star Trek that sort of lead into the Star Trek Picard show. And then I've also been writing a song a week for Star Trek Picard. So I'm like in this insane production schedule where I'm writing and recording a song. My goal is to do it a day after the episode comes out. So far I've been able to do that most weeks where an episode comes out on Thursday, the next day on Friday, I'm releasing a fully produced song with a video and everything. So it's been really, really crazy, but really, really fun. So if you like that, you can check out The Garage, or just go to strandedpanda.com and also the Stranded Panda YouTube channel is like the best way to follow along with all that stuff.
It's a good kind of one-shop shopping for all this. And I will say, as someone who's heard a lot of that music, and it's interesting because we talk about sort of Star Trek related media, I think when people think about Star Trek music, they think of Filk, you know, they think of parodies, they think of kind of the musical equivalent of Galaxy Quest. And while I love all that, I want to say, Matt, your music is not that. It's really, you know, it's beautiful, passionate, you know, great music that is inspired by Star Trek, the way music can be inspired by anything, but not in a kind of a silly or parody way, but really taking powerful moments from Star Trek and putting to music things that characters that a fan would have to say. I will also well, this is not necessarily a recommendation, but just a fun aside. To save time in my life, and because I listen to a lot of podcasts, I listen to most podcasts at 1.5 speed. And while I would definitely advise listening to Matt's songs at the speed they're supposed to be at, a couple of them at 1.5 speed can be a highly entertaining experience. Just in terms of some of my own stuff, also, for fans who haven't heard of this before, I also have a superhero ethics podcast and a Star Trek universe podcast with other people who
Star Wars.
I keep making this mistake. I have a Star Wars podcast. Matt has a Star Trek podcast. We kind of meet in the middle with Orville here. but pretty much any major cinematic property or TV property like that, if it's geeky, we probably talk about it somewhere on the Stranded Panda network. So check it out. Thanks, Matt. Thank you to all our listeners. And on behalf of myself and everyone else, keep tuning in. In a couple months, we'll be getting ready to kick off the Orville Season 2.
Thanks for listening to the Orville Universe Podcast. If you'd like to hear more from Matthew Westfox, search your podcatcher now for the Superhero Ethics Podcast. If you'd like to hear more from me, Matthew Carroll, search your podcatcher for the Marvel Cinematic Universe Podcast and the Star Trek Universe Podcast. Or you can check out my music. Just search for Matthew Carroll wherever you listen to music.